I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Two Jewish are two representatives of American Jewish World Service who are in Nepal doing relief work in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake there last week. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. In Jewish tradition, there is considerable discussion about which commandments are the most important. This is probably inevitable in view of the fact that we have 613 of these mitzvot, both ethical and ritual rules for living a sacred life, and it's only natural to try to determine which ones take precedence. In truth, out of the 365 negative commandments, the thou shalt not kinds of laws, and the 248 positive commandments, the you must do this sorts of rules, many are no longer even applicable. The world has changed over the course of the 3,200 years since the Torah was putatively given on Mount Sinai, and while these Jewish laws remain on the books, they are not all equally applicable, even for Orthodox Jews. The process of deciding which of the many laws, rules, and requirements that form the structure of Jewish commandments and created the system of Judaism itself still apply is an important issue. According to most religious authorities, there are currently 77 positive mitzvot commandments that you could do today and 194 negative commands that it's still possible to observe by not doing them. While far less than the original total, which included laws pertaining to animal sacrifice, making pilgrimage and bringing grain and other offerings to the temple in Jerusalem, the priesthood, and many agricultural requirements and restrictions that only applied in the biblical land of Israel, these are still far more rules than the majority of us can realistically be expected to know and observe. In addition, the large majority of Jews in the world are not Orthodox, either in theory or practice. For those of us who don't consider ourselves to be halachic, that is, mandated followers of Jewish law, many of these commandments are not relevant or even perhaps important, but some must be. For Judaism is a religion based on action, a combination of ritual practice and personal and communal ethics, both of which are established by mitzvot, commandments, and the commitment to observe them. So, which are the most important ones, and which might not be so crucial for observance? As you might imagine, this debate has been going on for a very long time, and since it is Jews doing the debating, there has never been full consensus on any resolution. Some believe that the moral mitzvot, the laws of ethics that are established in our tradition, are the only ones that truly must be observed. Others stress that this misses the true genius of Judaism, in which a system of ritual observance underlies and reinforces the ethics. If we don't have Shabbat at all, our understanding of the need we all have for rest and the requirement to respect other people's core human needs is impaired. If we value freedom but don't recall it ritually at Passover, when we celebrate the gift that it truly is, we are unlikely to grasp that our own ancestors were slaves, and so come to identify with the downtrodden as we should. If performing acts of charity and justice are relegated to the theoretical realm of high ethical acts, they never become the good habits that Jewish law requires them to be. It's all part of an important, ongoing discussion. While most of us know that there are 10 commandments that are the highest of our mitzvot, or at least the only ones we attribute directly to God's voice, there are so many other commandments and concepts to sort out. This question of what constitutes the highest of our values remains central to Jewish identity and meaning in 2015. To address this, we have a number of short statements in Jewish tradition that highlight some of the possibilities. These include, the world stands on three things, on Torah study, on worship, and on acts of kindness. Or, the world is sustained by three things, by truth, by justice, and by peace. or do not do that which is hateful to another person. All the rest is commentary. Or even, more than Jews have preserved the Shabbat, Shabbat has preserved the Jews. You know, we are approaching the holiday of Shavuot now, the festival when we remember receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai. It begins the evening of May 23rd, just a week from Saturday night. This is a great time to explore which of our values takes precedence in our lives and examine whether we are effectively making these the guides for how we act. For however we think about our religious experience, whether we focus on ethics or ritual, the ways in which we realize our ideals shapes who we are as people and just what our lives really mean. It is not only the number of commandments we observe, nor is it the quantity of commitments we make and fulfill that matter. It is that we have chosen to complete our covenant with God, to be the people we wish to be in a conscious way. If we can do that, we will have succeeded in finding the right path in life and discovered for ourselves the most important of all the commandments. And that will be a very good thing indeed. The Israeli version of the show The Voice recently created a new star, the French-Israeli singer Shirelle Bitan, now performing in Hebrew. The song that made it for her was the beautiful Meir Banai tune from back in 2007 called Lecha Elai. The words are much older, though. They were actually written by the great medieval biblical commentator and poet Abraham Ibn Ezra as a love poem to God. The text reads, "To you, my God, is my desire. In you is my pleasure and my love. To you is my heart and my body. To you is my spirit and soul. Bring me back and I shall return, and you shall desire my repentance. To you I shall shout, to you I shall cling until my return to the land. To you I will be as long as I live, until after my death. Bring me back." To play us in this morning, here's Shirelle Bitan and her rendition of Meir Banai's song, Lecha Elai.
Lecha Eli, teshukati, בכך אשקיע ואהבתי לך ליבי וכליותיי לך רוחי ונשמתי
was a beautiful version of Lecha Elai, To You, My God, Is My Desire, sung by Shirelle Bitan. Performing the sacred task of saving lives, pikuach nefesh, and rescuing those who are endangered, these are definitely central aspects of Jewish ethics. American Jewish World Service performs this work all around the globe, and we will have two of their employees, Sam Walthus and Aaron Acharya, with us by phone from Nepal in a few moments, explaining what the situation there is like and how American Jewish World Service is helping and how you can help the people of Nepal. Listen when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
We're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guests this morning. They are workers for the American Jewish World Service in Nepal. Sam Walthus and Aaron Acharya, who are in Nepal right now, attempting to alleviate some of the horrible situation that has existed since the earthquake there. Welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much. We're really thrilled to be speaking to you.
So tell me about coming to Kathmandu, what you've found, and what American Jewish World Service is doing there.
Sure. So AJWS, American Jewish World Service, is an organization that is inspired by the Jewish commitment to justice. We believe that we're obligated by our belief in justice to aid others who are facing terrible challenges. So it seems like a no-brainer for us to come to Nepal and to do the work that we do best around the world, and that's respond to disasters on both an immediate short-term basis and also for the medium and long-term reconstruction. We've been in Nepal since last Monday evening. We have seen a lot of changes in the very short time that we have been here. We are located right now in downtown Kathmandu in the relatively touristy area, and when we arrived, it was dark, it was desolate, there were very few people here. The only really people that we were seeing were emergency relief teams from all over the world, a couple of tourists who were trying to get out of the country, and of course, Nepali locals who were stuck here. In the past 3 days, we have seen the nightlife return, many more cars in the streets. The traffic is almost back to its unbearable self. And there are a lot more people walking around. Stores and shops are open. It's easier to find goods on the roads. So in terms of being in Kathmandu proper, there has been, life feels like it's relatively back to normal in the city. What we are seeing in the rural areas is vastly different. I'm sure all of you have heard what villages look like. Yesterday, we were in a small village west of Kathmandu, and of the 58 homes that are in that village, 55 were destroyed. Mm-hmm. And when I would watch the news and hear destroyed, I was thinking, a brick fallen here or there, or a leaning home, or maybe even a couple that were to the ground. And in fact, of the 55 we saw yesterday, every one of them were flat. They were just piles of rubble, dusty, sand, any kind of, housing supplies were trapped underneath these mounds of bricks. It's really incredibly tragic.
I've had the privilege of having Ruth Messenger on the show a couple of times. I know what American Jewish World Service does. When we come back, we'll talk about what it means to act in a Jewish way in these tragic circumstances, but the devastation is extreme. And I appreciate your being here. We will continue when we come back in a little bit here on Two Jewish. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from FlavorArt in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18 at gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com, T-O-O, JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrad Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrad.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the Christian support for Israel, CUFI, the Christians United for Israel, Friends of Israel. There's a number of Christian groups, Fellowship of Christians and Jews in support of Israel. There are certain programs that have now become very important for Christian voluntarism in Israel. Let's talk about that a little bit.
One of the programs that I was very impressed by is Sarel. And Sarel, mm-hmm. which is Gamalach.
Right.
And the coordinator is from Phoenix. Her name is Ellen Friedman. And last year she invited me to meet some of the volunteers, like kind of a reunion. And I was so impressed to see so many, you know, not Jewish volunteers who really take their time to go to IDF bases and do all these, you know,
menial tasks,
mamash,
right?
And yeah. In order, and they said in their own words, just to free the soldier to do what they really need to do. And some of them,
so sometimes that's kitchen duty and it's,
yeah,
you know,
and sort all kind of, you know,
sorting items.
Yeah,
and,
mainly, right. Yeah, mainly this is the main job that they're doing, and some of them going like for 3-10 times of every time 2 weeks. And they're paying for, of course, their
they
everything.
Pay for their own airfare. They pay,
yeah,
for their room and board.
During the week, they're at the IDF base, so they've been provided by food and stuff. But during the weekend, they have the time to enjoy Israel. And then on Sunday morning, like all the rest of the soldiers, they need to be at the Sunday, you know.
They have to be at their station on Sunday.
In Israel,
even
Sunday
for
it's
a work day.
It's Monday.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So, yeah.
And the people that do this, they get screened. It's a program. You can find out about this online.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that do it have to be screened carefully, and they pay all their own expenses.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
This used to be a program for Jews who were too old to go join the IDF or too old to make Aliyah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really true anymore. Now it seems to be primarily a Christian program. How do Israelis feel about that?
Very good. I as a point of view of an Israeli, or even just a human being, actually, I think in not just in addition to the really to the work that they are providing, the one of the benefits, and I think it's one of the most important benefits, that they are coming from all different places, Jews and non-Jews together, getting to know really each other and Israel and the real Israel. And when they are coming back to their countries, they are ambassadors of Israel because they really can see the soldier and are not, as you can see on the headlines, and they can understand deeply the reality in Israel. So I think it's one of the importance that not just Jews, because when a Jewish people, you know, tell you about Israel and how then the reality, it's different when a Christian, you know, support Israel. It's just more, I don't know, will you help me find a word?
Yeah,
it's more,
it feels, it's so much better to be appreciated by somebody from the outside.
It's like, I'll tell you, my daughter is the prettier, you know, it's,
and
you
she
know,
is
biased.
Your daughters
I'm
are beautiful, absolutely. But it's better to hear it from me than for you to tell me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
so
that's
they're
right.
Not biased. They really see the reality and they
they're
deliver.
Objective. They have an objectivity.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Oshrad. We'll talk next week.
Toda Rabbi.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There are interesting developments in France where Le Pen and the National Front took a bunch of Jewish votes. This is stunning. Maybe you can explain the whole scene.
Well, there are actually two parallel developments in French politics that are very interesting. One is the debate raging in France over their version of the Patriot Act, which the prime minister went out of his way to characterize as, this is not a French version of the Patriot Act, but of course it is. And it goes against deeply cherished principles in France of privacy and a lack of government snooping and government interference. France for so long had an absolute monarchy and then so-called republican governments that abused their powers, that the French are extremely leery of any overstepping by the government. And yet, they've had a number of terrorist incidents, Charlie Hebdo among them, and they have a huge problem with the degree to which their Islamic population is radicalized. So that whole debate is raging in parallel with the reemergence of the National Front, Le Front National, which is abbreviated in French as FN, which was founded by a guy who's now a fairly old man, Jean-Marie Le Pen, but it's now run by his daughter, Marine Le Pen. And the names sound oddly similar.
They do.
But father and daughter are very different. Father, when he founded the party many years ago, when I was living in France, actually, at one point in the first round of the presidential elections, scored 16.5%, which was huge. Nobody expected him to get more than 5%, which is a typical splinter party result.
Fringe party extremist.
Right. And all the experts and political pundits were shocked and worried about the future of France when they did this well. But he was dubbed by the international press as a neo-Nazi, in part because he once dismissed the Holocaust or described the Holocaust as a detail of history, which clearly offended not only French Jews, but Jews and historically sensitive people all over the world. His daughter has gone out of her way to distance herself from that position, to say, I reject anti-Semitism. Jews have an important place in France. The Holocaust was more than a detail of history. It was one of the great tragedies of the 20th century, blah, 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 blah. So father and daughter publicly exchange insults and barbs. And the party is now definitely run by the daughter, although it was created by the father. And part of its attraction for the Jewish voter in France is its rabid positions against immigrants in general and Islamic immigrants in particular. And I think we should discuss further the reaction of many societies, actually, to the growing radicalization of Islamic populations and the growing percentage of their own populations that is Islamic during our next show.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll maybe also talk about how many Jews actually voted for that party and why when we come back next week. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
When we come back, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe gets a new dog, and he can't wait to show him off to his friend Shlomo. When Shlomo gets there, Moshe calls the dog into the house and brags about how smart he is. The dog runs up and starts looking up at his master, tail wagging furiously, mouth open, tongue hanging out, eyes bright with anticipation. Moshe points to the newspaper on the couch and commands, "Fetch!" Immediately, the dog climbs onto the couch but sits down. His tail stops wagging. The doggy's smile disappears. Looking up at his master, the dog says in a whiny voice, "You think this is easy, wagging my tail all the time? Oy vey, it hurts from so much wagging. I'm going to get arthritis. And you think that expensive organic dog food you feed me tastes good? It's dreck. You should try it. And you don't seem to care about me anymore. You shove me out the door to pee 3 times a day, and that's it. I can't remember the last time you took me for a walk. You should be ashamed." Shlomo is amazed. "Wow, your dog is sitting there and complaining." "I'm sorry," says Moshe. "He's still young. I'm training him. He thought I said kvetch." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. You know, kvetch, not fetch. Forget it. And now a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we complete reading the book of Leviticus with the portion of the Torah known as Bechukotai. At the completion of a text that's focused on holiness and the rituals of sanctification and celebration, we conclude our exploration with a statement of Brit, covenant. God says, "If you keep these, my laws of holiness, you will long flourish in the land that I'll give you." This is a promise based on actions. If we live lives dedicated to holiness, our actions will bring blessings. We have the capacity to create a world that has meaning and goodness, and will get God's support. But holiness is really a strange concept. In Judaism, holiness is something that we create rather than something given us from above or outside. An example to demonstrate. A sheepskin is not a holy object, right? Where I'm from in Southern California originally, you use it to cover your car seats if you have a convertible. Nothing holy in that. So, what happens when you take a sheepskin, remove the hair, cure it into parchment? Is it holy now? No, it's just a piece of parchment suitable for diploma writing, appropriate in this month of May. But if you take that same parchment, give it to a sofer, a scribe, who writes on it a section of the text of a sacred book like the Torah, and if that piece of parchment is now sewn together with other texts like that, and if the whole parchment is wrapped around atzei chaim, wooden poles, and if it's dedicated and carried around a synagogue and chanted from publicly and blessings are sung over it and it's used for a bar or bat mitzvah and touched and kissed with fringes of a talis, well, now that piece of parchment has become something much more than it was. It has become holy. But it has become holy through our own actions. We took a common object, a sheepskin that could have been used for any number of things, and created out of it an object that is truly sacred. Similarly, the abiding lesson of Leviticus is that we have the capacity to make our own lives holy in much the same way. We can lead lives that are ordinary and prosaic, unclean sheepskins, I suppose, or we can choose to live truly holy lives. That choice is ultimately a personal one, but it is also an ethical one. We make that choice every day, sometimes every hour or minute, when we decide how we are going to act towards others, and how much commitment we are going to demonstrate towards the sacred parts and institutions in our lives. When we give freely of ourselves, as Leviticus asks, we increase holiness in the world, and in doing so, we invest our lives with meaning, beauty, and sanctity. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guests, Sam Walthus and Aaron Acharya of American Jewish World Service, will tell us what the situation on the ground is like in Nepal, where they are working to help alleviate suffering and set up rebuilding efforts in this earthquake-torn nation, learn what's being done, what still needs to be done, and what you can do to help when we come back in a few moments here on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us?
The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... At Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Lots of Israel news this week. First, at the 11th hour or later, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu managed to cobble together the 61 votes in the Knesset he needed to form a bare majority government. By convincing Naftali Bennett of Bayit Yehudi, the Jewish Home Party, to join a narrow right-wing religious coalition with Likud, Shas, United Torah Judaism, and the centrist Kulanu Party, Netanyahu has produced a government. But this is just about the longest it has ever taken an election winner to produce a coalition that can govern. And had it gone an extra hour or two, the Israeli president, Reuven Rivlin, would likely have given the opportunity to form a new government to Netanyahu's left-of-center opposition. To get Bennett and the Jewish Home Party into coalition, Netanyahu had to make him education and diaspora affairs minister and give Bennett's party the powerful justice ministry, among other posts. To gain the support of the religious party, Bibi had to make an about-face on the new laws that removed most of the much-abused yeshiva deferment for ultra-Orthodox young men. There is, however, no truth to the rumor that every single member of Knesset in each of the new coalition's parties was given an important ministry in the new government and a really fancy office. However, it is believed to be true that every one of their children was supplied by midnight with home delivery of a huge container of ice cream from Sarah Netanyahu's personal gelato store. Anyway, this will be a government of Israel that begins its reign taking several very unpopular positions, and it remains to be seen how long it can last. Now beginning his fourth term as prime minister, somehow or other Netanyahu manages to remain in power. The Israeli political system may be dysfunctional in many ways, but Bibi Netanyahu always manages to outfox everyone and continues to call the shots. And now he will very likely outlast Barack Obama and have a new U.S. president to work with or against. It isn't pretty, But then our own U.S. government doesn't look so gorgeous these days either, to be honest. There is some more nasty politicking going on now, this time on the international scene, over the world's favorite sport, soccer or football. Israel's top soccer administrators met with the International Soccer's FIFA president Sepp Blatter in Zurich last week to avert a vote called by the Palestinians to suspend Israel from the World Soccer Body. An official from Israel's Football Association said that Chairman Ofer Eini and Chief Executive Rotem Kamer would urge Blatter to use his influence to strike the Palestinian Football Association's proposal from the FIFA Congress agenda on May 29th. If FIFA did suspend Israel, it would bar all its teams and clubs from competing in international events, including World Cup qualification tournaments. Although not uncommon, the world body has suspended nations mainly when a government has intervened in its soccer association's affairs. Israel is currently competing in the Euro 2016 qualifying event. Its clubs will join European Cup tournaments in July, when Israel is also due to host the European Women's Under-19 Championships. Suspensions would force the event to be moved. Blatter said he does not think Israel should be suspended and will prevent the measure from being brought to the FIFA membership for a vote. For the Palestinians' proposal to pass, it would need the approval of 75% of FIFA's 209 member associations. Palestinians say that Israel continues to hamper its activities. They complain of restrictions on the movement of players between the Gaza Strip and the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israel cites security concerns for restrictions it imposes in the West Bank, where the Palestinian Authority exercises self-rule, and along the border with the Gaza Strip, which is controlled by the Islamist terror group Hamas. In a letter to all the FIFA members, Eini appealed for them to reject PFA Chief Jibril Rajoub's proposal, saying it was a flagrant move that seeks to mix politics with sports, something that is completely contrary to FIFA's vision. Rajoub has also complained Israel should not include five teams in its leagues from West Bank settlements and about racism against Arabs in Israeli soccer, a claim the Israel Football Association said is ridiculous and cantankerous. One Israeli club, Beitar Jerusalem, has refused to employ Arab players, but all the other top Israeli soccer clubs regularly have Arabs, and since the 1970s, Arab players have been on Israel's national team. By the way, I recall personally meeting with Jibril Rajoub in the mid-1990s in Gaza City when he was then the director of security for Yasser Arafat and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, and I was on an Arza reform rabbinical mission promoting peace. Today, I doubt Rajoub could even enter Gaza City safely himself, with or without a soccer ball. Miraculously, of the 250 Israelis who were initially reported missing in Nepal after the earthquake struck that country a couple of weeks ago, only one has died. Tragically, it was Or Asraf, a 22-year-old former Golani soldier from the elite Egos reconnaissance unit of the IDF and an experienced trekker. Asraf was caught in one of the over 100 avalanches that followed the quake and killed instantly. He was buried in Israel last week. It is very sad. He died doing what he loved. May his memory bring only blessing. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our special guest this morning, Sam Walthus and Aaron Acharya, who are with the American Jewish World Service in not only Kathmandu, but in some of the surrounding areas, trying to alleviate the suffering, working with a variety of organizations and aid agencies. When you arrived there, the only thing that we've really heard, aside from terrible devastation, some of the photos of devastation that we've seen, somewhere between 7,500 and 10,000 deaths. There must be tens of thousands of people injured, and I've heard hundreds of thousands of people that are homeless. All of those numbers kind of boggle the mind. That's not the same thing as seeing sort of the personal take on the devastation. What's the first thing that you need to do there?
You know, the first thing that we need to do is ask the local people what it is that they want and not assume what it is that they need. So AGWS really has core principles that it works with when working around the world. And we feel that local people on the ground should be able to tell us what it is that they need and how we can help fill those gaps that the international community isn't doing. So it's about, you know, standing in partnership with people. It's about solidarity, and it's certainly not about dictating what we think is going to be best for them. So I would say the first and most important thing that we do is we listen. We sit with people in communities. We listen. We ask questions, and we sit back and try to figure out which gaps are left in the response efforts and how we can best fill those gaps.
Aaron, I understand that you are able to translate. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, I grew up in this part of the world. I was born and brought up in Bhutan until my late teens, and then I spent a few years in Eastern Nepal. Then I lived a little bit in Darjeeling before moving to the States. So yes, I I know how a village functions, how living space is used in Nepali home. So I am kind of like attuned to the concept and expectations of people. Yeah.
So it must be doubly painful to see some of the devastation. Sam, I want to follow up a little bit. One of the challenges in administering aid in an emergency region, as you said, is finding out what people really need as opposed to what we might think they need. There were some lessons that AJWS learned and has tried to convey that took from the, for example, the Haiti disaster about 5 years ago. How do you apply those kinds of lessons coming in Nepal and being on the ground right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. You know, we know that those that are marginalized or the most vulnerable in a community are those that are disproportionately affected by a disaster. So we come in and we identify who those communities are, and those are the communities that we prioritize. So in the case of Nepal, not unlike Haiti, we really prioritize communities such as the LGBT community or communities such as the Dalit community, which is the lowest caste in the Nepali caste system. We work with organizations that are supporting women in rural areas. We work with the Tibetan refugee community who have very, very little rights in Nepal. And those are the organizations and the individuals that we start with. And I think that was one of those are the lessons that we learn over and over again in disasters, that those are the communities that are neglected and, again, who are disproportionately affected when a disaster hits. We also know to invest in infrastructure now to prevent larger disasters in the future. So what that means is we hang on to our money once the immediate relief has happened. We actually sit back for a few months and hang on to our money and assess the situation. And we know that in a few months, sadly, the next disaster will happen. It will be on the cover of the New York Times and Nepal will be forgotten. And larger aid organizations will be gone. The immediate relief will have been provided. And so we will be looked to help continue in the long-term support, rehabilitation, and reconstruction efforts that these communities need to do and go through in order to get back to life pre-disaster.
Sam and Aaron, I've heard that the first country to bring aid, or certainly one of the first, was Israel, and that Israel came up with, there were something like 300 Israeli aid workers in the country within a few days. And that it has continued to work. Now, this, again, is kind of triage assistance. Have you encountered any of that? And, Jews are obviously interested in what other Jews are doing, but also interested in what Israeli Jews are doing for Nepal.
Sure. Well, you know, as many people know, Israel has, you know, great expertise in disaster relief. They have incredible medics. They have strong search and rescue teams. They're able to put up hospitals in a very short period of time. And they've done that here in Nepal. We, AJWS, AJWS collaborates closely with other Jewish organizations in everyday normal life and also in times of disaster. And just yesterday, we were meeting with three or four key organizations that are here on the ground to make sure that, A, we're not duplicating efforts, and, B, that we're sharing, you know, partner stories and making sure that we're collaborating and that this aid can be done as effectively and efficiently as possible.
What can people do? What's the right way for people who feel a need to help now to respond?
So we are impressing upon the international community who has been, I will say that the North American Jewish community has been incredibly generous. AJWS in the first 5 days of this disaster received over $800,000. So I really commend the American population at large and specifically the Jewish community who has really stepped up in response to this disaster. It's important for people to know that while they have incredibly good intentions when they pack a box and ship a blanket or a sleeping bag or some dry goods, that those actually pose more of a problem than sending funds into the country. And I want to explain, take a minute to explain the why behind that, because I think it's very easy for individuals to assume that sending old t-shirts or shoes or a brand new jacket to Nepal is as valuable as sending $18, $50, or $100 to a local group on the ground. In disaster situations, the change happens constantly. There's constant change. The context changes daily. The work on the ground looks very different. As I said, you know, Kathmandu is a very different city today than it was on Monday. So we need to be able to have flexibility in response to that change in context. And money is the most flexible way in order to be able to do that. The second piece is that supply chain management in times of disaster is incredibly important. And what I mean by that, you heard about the incredible delays in the airport and that aid supplies were having a very hard time getting to local communities. And partly, it's because Nepal was receiving hundreds, thousands of boxes of dry goods and blankets and jackets, and that was clogging the system and not allowing the medical supplies and the things that were most needed to get out into the community to get out as quickly as possible. And thirdly, you want the economy in Nepal to bounce back as quickly as possible. So enabling people to buy their goods and to procure goods that are made here in Nepal that are culturally appropriate for the local culture. You want that to take place rather than importing granola bars. You want to make sure that the villagers are eating what they're used to eating and that they're able to cook their rice and get back to normalcy as quickly as possible. So I would, you know, in short, tell people to send funds if they are inspired to help the situation here.
The government plays a big role in the success or failure of a country in maintaining building standards, having effective road networks, being able to restore power when it's brought down, even in disasters. The Nepalese government doesn't have the strongest infrastructure or the best reputation for being able to do those things. How does an NGO, a non-government organization, an aid group like American Jewish World Service, how do you work with and around an ineffectual, I don't know how else to say it nicely, government?
Yes, Nepal is a very, very complicated political system right now. The government has been trying to put together a constitution for the last many years, and that even in normal times, it's a quite dysfunctional system. So that is the government part of it. The government bureaucracies are a piece of it. It's very bureaucratic. There's not a pretty smoothly functioning system here. There's also a desire to make sure that all the funds are accumulated in the same place and the government can centralize everything. That also makes it a nightmare for a lot of the NGOs who have different priorities and different missions on the ground. So that's the political piece of it. And then the social politics, social dynamics are very, very different in this country. There have been history of discrimination against certain population. There has been a history of fighting. It just came out of a huge civil war recently. They are still building peace among themselves. So it's a complicated atmosphere function. In the middle of that, we bring international NGOs who are positioned here already, and then there are new ones like us coming in to fund the project. There are established local organizations. Many of them are human rights organizations, advocacy organizations. We have been seeing a dearth of service organizations on the ground. Add to the mix a very, very young population of entrepreneurs who have been, many of them, educated abroad and who have come here to support the system. And they're setting up shops and coffee shops in any vacant area, staging areas, and they're trying to help the best they can. So it is a very, very well-meaning system, but it's very, very disorganized right now. So it's going to be tough. And then bring the government piece in that, where they would like to regulate everything, try to make sure that things go to certain places instead of other places, that the politics comes in, local representation comes in. So it's a complicated atmosphere to handle. I think the best way for us to understand who we need to talk to, a lot of the civil society organizations are affiliated with one political party or the other, understanding that system and making sure that we are not spending resources on a single, on just one portion of the population, making sure that we are reaching out to all of the populations, rather we are not pitting one against the other. The principle of do no harm, making sure that we are funding projects that will not bring more animosity among people. Being aware of all of those local norms and cultures is very important. And that's why one of the primary things that we are trying to do here is hire something local that will assist us navigate that very, very complex system and make sure that our funds are going to the right place and to function in this. We reach these people to recognizing the government and all of the existing structures right now.
It's a complicated job. Can we talk sort of in conclusion about the Jewish motivation to do this? I think about Pekuach Nefesh, saving lives, as the central effort. But even beyond saving lives, it's trying to prevent tragedies like this from happening in the future. Sam, what's the American Jewish World Service perspective on this?
Yeah, sure. I'll start by saying that we have a decades-long history of responding to disasters around the world. So we obviously responded, you alluded to the Haiti earthquake, and still have a huge presence on the ground there. We were in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan in 2013. Of course, we responded to the Ebola outbreak, specifically in Liberia. So we have extensive experience doing this work. We believe in, as I said earlier, we're inspired by the Jewish commitment to justice, and we believe that we're obligated by our belief in justice to aid those that are facing terrible, terrible challenges. And for some, this is a religious belief, and for others, it's just an acknowledgement that Jews have suffered terribly in the past and that we are sensitive to the needs of all who suffer. So I think that's who we are, and I think we do it really, really well. And as Jews, I think we're really proud to be responding to terrible circumstances such as Nepal.
I think the final question has any. Were there any great surprises when you got to Nepal?
I think I'm always enamored by people's resilience. I think it's a surprise necessarily, but when we watch the news, we tend to pity, we tend to victimize, and we think that we are better served by really walking in partnership with people and extending our solidarity and building relationships and coming in with that intention and empowering people to dictate what they need for themselves and how they can build back better is really what we're all about. And so I would just go back to say that, I think we feel incredibly privileged to be able to do that, and to do that in the name of American Jewish World Service is an honor. And so I guess I'm not surprised that people are who they are, but it's quite wonderful to see people still laughing on the street, considering our house is in complete shambles at this point, and their lives in some cases, people very close to them have been lost as a result of this terrible tragedy, and yet they're still willing to pick up and to move forward. And we're privileged to be here.
If people want to find out more about American Jewish World Service and about your work in Nepal, I know you're blogging it there, they can go to the AJWS website. What's that called?
www.ajws.org. www.samwalthus.org.
Just like you would think. I want to thank Sam Walthus, who has a fantastic first name, and Aaron Acharya for joining us here on Too Jewish. Continued success with this really challenging and extraordinarily important Jewish work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Judith Frank, author of the fine novel All I Love and Know. Our playout this morning comes from the Yeshiva University begun a cappella group, the Maccabees. Their version of the Shabbat Zmira, Dror Yikra, kind of borrowed from the pop song Cups. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Dror Yikra, Levenim Bar, Vin Tzachem Kimo Vavar, Nim Shimchem Bilo Yushpat, Shivu Vinuchu V'yom Shabbat, Dirosh Navi, V'yulami, V'yot Yeshar Seimi, Tassorek B'toch Ami, דרך פורה בתוך בצד וגם בבאר אשר גם